Could I first ask you, Mr. Anderson, where and when you were born?
I was born at 12th of October 1923 in Dalston, which is Hackney, I suppose you might say, London.
What were the names of your parents?
Arthur William, and my parents' name was, well, my mother's name was Florence. She was French. My father was English. We had five children. I was the second eldest. And my father had a shop which was selling meat for animals, you know. And from there on in, that's all I can remember about my school. Went to school.
Would they send you to the local school?
Oh, we went to the local school. My father, you know, had no money. So he sent me to local school where I went until I was 11. And then went to what they call it today, they call it the senior school, I presume, until I was 14. And then obviously I had to leave at 14 because the father's business wasn't very good. Mm. So he would prefer me to have got a job if I could.
Mm. Did he have any particular kind of job in mind? Would he have liked you to have gone into his
business? No idea at all. I mean, his business was never good anyway, it was finished. Mm. So I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I thought I'd try this diamond merchants in Hatton Garden, where I managed to get a job learning the trade of making rings and cutting diamonds, but I didn't stay very long, just 6 months.
How did you hear about them?
They came through the school, you know, where the people come round to the school to find out what you want to do, and I had no idea, so, you know, they suggested that and I tried it, but it didn't work. And I was there for 6 months. And then I got myself a job through the papers, actually, in the solicitor's office in Old Broad Street, or off Old Broad Street, which I had to go out every hour, on the hour, to see if there was any business that they could pick up. And I went to, I used to go to a place called Gresham House, and having to go there, you know, three or four times a day, I knew the lift man quite well, and I was getting a bit fed up with just walking backwards and forwards and going back to the office and sitting there for 1 hour until the next time. So I said to him, I said, do you know anybody who wants a likely lad? He said, well, I've got just a place for you. He said, I'll drop you off on the way up. So he dropped me off on the second floor and said, told them I sent you in. So I went in a firm called F&N Derlacker, which was three rooms as their offices.
Can you remember when that was?
That was a year after I left school. Mm. Yes, August 1938.
What did you do? Did you arrive and tell them that you'd heard there was work?
I walked in there and I asked for the manager and I said, the lift man has sent me in. They said, you were looking for a lad. So he said, yes. So we had a little talk, told me what he wanted me to do, to make the coffee, post the mail. And one thing now, I thought, well, he'll make a change if nothing else. So he said, well, when can you start? I said, well, I'll start whenever you want me to start. So he said, well, the following Monday. So I started the following Monday, and apart from making the coffee and making the tea and watching everybody go in and out the office all day long, I found it was getting very rather interesting. And of course in those days we used to, when there was a bargains were done, there were names to be written out and transfers to be made out, and I took an interest in all this, what was going on. And I volunteered the people who were doing these sort of jobs, you know, I said, could I do anything for you? Which normally came round about account week, when there used to be hundreds of transfers to be made out, and names which were passed from broker to jobber, from jobber to broker, you know, because we were the middlemen. And these had to be split up more than occasionally, more often than not, because you never bought and sold the same amount of chairs all the time, so you split one of the names and you, and that. So I got into this, and I found this very interesting, and I was rather enjoying myself. And then, of course, this went on till the wars came. And I think that was a slight, well, more than slightly, it was beneficial to me in respect, because I was still a bit too young to go to the war. And so there was one or two people going, and one person who was going was the transfer clerk. So I got the offer, you know, would I like to run the transfer clerk, and which I knew because I'd been watching, I didn't look like I could run basically without being any big headed or anything like that. I think I could have run quite a bit of it, you know, the job in ledgers and that, because I took an interest, and I thought, so I found something I like. And so I did that until 1941. Well, then it was my turn to go to the war. So, but I'd found myself a niche there where I thought, if I come back, the job is there for me. I was told this, you know, the job is there for me when you come back. And so that's how it stood. So I went away for approximately, I suppose, about 6 years. I came back in February 1947. And I'd only been back about 3 or 4 weeks, and I went down with appendicitis. And my father, you know, the manager came home with me and said, you know, look after him, tell him he can stay away for a couple of weeks. Gave my father some of money. And my father couldn't believe this, you know. And he said to me then, he said, son, whatever you do, he said, you've got a job for life there. So, and that's how it went on. So then after a while, I got the offer of a red button, you know, which is a button which allows you to go checking bargains in the, what used to be underneath the stock exchange in one place now. And I got that, and I found that most interesting. I was really enjoying life. And then I got the offer of a blue button through the mistake of somebody else, which I, you know, very lucky person.
How do you mean the mistake?
Well, he was a blue button, which is on the floor of the house. He runs the messages. And the art of running messages is as quick as possible and come back with the answers as quick as possible. But, well, he went, instead of going to what they called a box where the people were, he went to the offices and was away too long, you know, and they didn't know what was happening. So he, unfortunately, was sent back to the office because it was a question of speed and one, you know, because he weren't the only one trying to get to the focus. And I got the offer. And, of course, I jumped at it. You know, I couldn't believe it. From where I came from, you know, it was absolutely unbelievable.
About how old were you when you became a blue button?
They got me now.
Was it still in the 1940s?
I suppose, when did I come back? 1923, 40? Yes, I suppose about 26, I suppose, yes. Yes, that's right, yes. 23, 46, yeah, be about right. Well, no, a bit more than that. No, I think about 28.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down, and they give you a little book, and there's all islands, or there were islands in the market there where you had to go and call the waiter and ask them to call so-and-so and so-and-so. And this wasn't too easy, actually, because there were so many firms you had you call, you know, mm-hmm. and so many stands there, and you had to remember, or try to remember, where every broker was so that you went off in the correct direction from the word go, you know. So anyway, I devised a system around that. Anyway, it worked all right.
Can you remember what the system was?
Well, yes, I used to sort of, if I'm standing here and there's a pillar, we're all standing on pillars, well, the answer was, if you're lucky enough, you duck behind the pillar and get your little book out and have a look where it was and then go straight to it. Because it didn't always work, because sometimes they used to be on the stand in front of you. So, but anyway, that was okay. And I think they must have been pleased with me, because, I mean, I kept a job, obviously. And I took a lot of notice what went on, really, you know, because I was in what I call a world that I would never have dreamt of, to have got there. And I used to, after a while, I used to know all the prices, and I used to remember a lot of what we call limits, you know, which were there in the book. And this went on, you know, and I thoroughly enjoyed myself. And then one day, I think it was about 1951. I was called into the partner's room, and they said, "Well, how would you like to become a dealer?" You know, I said, "Oh, you know, I was absolutely dumbfounded, actually, because where I come from, I couldn't have anticipated anything like this." So I said, "Well," I said, "I'd love to. I'd love to have a try." So I was authorised. And I'll never forget the first morning, because I, watching everybody else, nobody seemed to pick up a book to make the price. It was made off what was there the night before, what you think this thing's going to open the next morning. And I'll never forget it, because the first price I was asked was the price in House of Fraser. And my mind went absolutely blank. No matter what it was, whatever the stock was, it would have been the same. Anyway, it's House of Fraser, and so my tutor, or my partner, was standing behind me.
Who was that?
Mr. Pat Derlecker, one of the best, well, to my mind, the best jobber that I could have ever learned from. So he said, "Well, pick up the book." So I picked up the book, and the price was crazy price today, $7.15, $7.16, it's over the figure. You know, it's a very complicated effort, that one. So anyway, so he didn't say nothing, he was quite happy. So then I started and doing a little bit of business here and there. And then suddenly somebody came along and asked me, this is the first big deal I ever did, by the way, a price in metal box. And I can't remember the exact price, but there was a sixpenny price and, you know, whatever you made it in. So I made the price, and I remember making 3p outside in 50,000 shares. And so Pat Derlecker standing behind me, never said a word, never said nothing. So the fellow said, "Well, I'll sell you 50,000. I said, "Buy 50,000. And that's how it was done, you know. But I think, sure, the price was 54 shillings at the time. Anyway, so Mr. Pat Derlecker says to me, he said, "Well, now, what are you going to do with that?" I said, "Well, I'm going to offer them to Mullins." So he said, "What are you going to offer them at?" I said, 54 and 6. He said, "Fair enough." Off I go. Comes back. I said, "I've sold them at 54 and 6. And so that made my absolute, you know, that gave me the confidence from then on to carry on. Mm-hmm. You know, if it had gone wrong, I wouldn't have known what would have happened, but it didn't go wrong. And that's how I think I started on the way up.
Can I pause a bit and review some of the things you said? Have you any early memories of the Derlecker offices when you started? Were they a small firm?
Oh, very good. There was 1, 2, 3, 4. There used to be 6 partners and a staff of about 16. Mm. We had 2 rooms. There was a partner's room right up in the corner, and then we had 2 rooms. The partner's room, in actual fact, was about this size, not much bigger than this. And then we had another 2 rooms where the staff used to sit. Mm. The manager and the jobber's ledgers, name clerks, and transfer clerks. And I think that was about it. There was no more than that.
Mm. How did they compare with other firms at the time? Because we think of Derlecker now as being, you know, one of the biggest jobbing firms in the stock exchange.
I suppose we were on a par with, I think we was in the top 3 or 4, because nobody was very big in those days. And but what used to happen, I don't think I'm giving away trade secrets. What used to happen was the senior partner, more often than not, used to come in the morning with orders in his pockets, which I don't think Well, I don't know, it doesn't happen so much today, put it that way. Because, I mean, most of it now won't go through the brokers. But then, but I think that the answer to that being that my senior partner then, Mr. Esmond Derlacher, he had very good contacts outside. And I believe this is where a lot of it came from. So that was beneficial to the firm, you know, to the firm and to the staff, actually, because the staff always seemed to get a sort of a bonus if there was any of these big orders and, you know, we hit it off all right.
Mm. These would be orders from clients?
From clients, yes.
Mm. What kind of clients were they at the time? Were they private clients or were they institutions? You know, we now think about the pension funds and so on.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't care to answer that because I really didn't know at the time.
Yes, yeah.
Because I didn't know where they come from, actually. Because, as I say, at those times, you know, you were just given the business, you know. Mm. And that sort of thing.
Well, then the dealers have to go and put them through a broker in
You book them through a broker. Mm. Yeah, it was always the same broker, so maybe the connections were through the broker. You know, through maybe the brokers. I don't know. I really don't know where the orders came from, you know, whether it's institutions or private. I don't know.
Which stocks were they trading in those days, in the late 30s? Can you remember? Markets, I mean, you know, was it industrials or...?
No, the industrial market, no, it was... It used to be rubber shares. And then from then on they went, I don't know when, I can't remember. We can't remember that. And the brewery market, sorry, that was the one, that was the other one. Brewery market and the rubber market. And then the rubber market was more or less finished. And then there was just in the brewery market. And then from then on, we went from the brewery market, we stayed in the brewery market and went into industrials, which I can't remember when we did that. 1949, 1950. And then gradually, you know, as the time went on, we took up more industrials and so forth. And then we took up, well, we took over, I suppose one might say, one or two brokers who didn't quite make it, you know. Which in those days, I think, you know, they weren't enormous to help them out and take them over, you know, if they couldn't afford to carry on the business. Which, I mean, you know, today you'd get hammered, or a few years ago you'd get hammered, but those days, I think they tried to club together so as not to create any trouble for private people, basically. Mm.
Were there any other people from your background working in the office who'd come from that part of London?
No.
How would you describe the backgrounds of the other people in the firm during your early days with it?
Well, I think they were all, I think, I would guess, although I never discussed it with them, I would have guessed they all came from, put it this way, they didn't leave school at 14. They went on to what they used to call in those days, secondary schools or whatever, until they were 16, 17. And I think this is where they came from. And I think the majority of them, I'm almost saying all of them, I would guess. And, but they didn't, that didn't deter me at the time. And I don't think it worried them to any extent, you know. My language was slightly different at that time, actually, to what most of them were. But once I realised that I was going to possibly go places, of course, I sort of tried to speak differently, you know, try to not speak their language because I wouldn't want to put that on because I don't think that would have got me anywhere. So they just took me as I came.
What did the people at home think about the job you were doing? Did they have much idea about what the stock exchange was?
Oh, nothing
at
all. Nothing at all. I'm to be honest, nor did I. You know, I mean, I only learned about it by getting the job and then being so interested that I studied the whole thing. But otherwise, I mean, I don't think my father even heard of it, to be honest, but, you know, with all due respects to him. Nor my rest of my family, I suppose. My sisters had never heard of it, you know, and I think I must have been the only one leaving home, going to work in the mornings with a suit and a collar and tie. You know, it really was a great thrill for me from that point of view. But I don't think anybody knew anything about it in those days, because it never advertised. Well, it never advertised until what? A few years ago, really, truly. I mean, when I say a few, I mean, say 20 years. But it was never, I shouldn't think people ever thought about it 40 years ago.
Do you recall what happened to the firm when the war broke out? Did a lot of people go off to join the forces?
Oh, yes, quite a few. Yes, quite a few went. That's why I say I think that it was a great benefit to me to sort of step in. And we managed, you know, the business was never so vast during the war, or not the early part of the war, put it that way, because I left in, as I say, I think I left in 41. So I only did about 18 months after people started to go. Mm. But at least it was enough to set me on the road to where I finished up. Mm.
Did most of the partners go off?
Some of them did. I remember Mr. Jack Derlacher, he did. He was a prisoner of war for, I think, for about 7-8 years of memory. And but then again, by the time I came back, everybody was back, you know. So I had to, well, I didn't have to start all over again because business was quite good. And I went in with a fellow who I took over from on the transfer clerk, you know, for that short period of time, until I say I got the offer of being a red button and then transferring to a blue button.
Do you remember what it was like going into the stock exchange, the floor of the house, when you first started as a blue button? Was it a very intimidating place?
Oh, horrifying. Horrifying. Because, I felt as if I was the odd man out, obviously. Because where I was brought up and the schooling I went to. And I'm pretty sure I was at the time. But after I'd been there a while, I used to talk to the people. And there used to be a lot of one-man firms in the market at that time. And, you know, you get to talk to them. And they took me as I came, which was a great help to me. And so I wasn't too worried about it. It took me about 3 or 4 months to get used to it. Every morning you walk in there and there's an enormous building, enormous dome, and all the people standing about, you know, and you know who they are, you know them. You know where they've come from, and you know where you've come from, obviously. And suddenly, you know, you think to yourself, well, you know, where can I go from here? But, as I say, you know, I talked to people after a while, and they talked to me, and they called me Tommy, and this, that, and the whole thing went down absolutely perfect. Mm.
Were there many jobbers at the time when you first went into the stock exchange?
Oh, yes, there were lots. Well, I say lots because there was quite a few one-man firms. Mm.
What kind of business did the one-man firms do? Were they doing different types of bargains, different size bargains to?
Oh yes, they
firms
would only
like
do
Derlacher.
The small bargains. But what they were, you had a lot of people there, or just say a lot of people, and I mean a large percentage of people would always try to give these one-man firms a turn. You know, so they'd go up to, for example, they'd go up to them and say, look, I want to buy 5,000 ICI, and I'm prepared to give this for them. So if you can get them cheaper, you can take a turn out of it for yourself. Mm. And so what they did then, of course, they came to myself or other jobbers in the market and said, you know, look, I can give this for 5,000 ICI. But the price was never that far wrong, you know. But what it did, it gave the man concerned a turn, which, you know, which is basically all they could live on, you see. And they might have made £200 or £300 out of it. Mm. And it didn't do any jobber any harm, because they never got big business, just a small man. And suddenly, you know, they did it to give him a turn, and he was quite happy. He'd most probably go home if he did one or two of those a day, you know, rather than sit about there all day long. But it was a fabulous setup for people like that. Where they came from, I wouldn't know. So, you know, they were there when I got there, so I don't know how long they'd been there.
Where did they go to in the end? Well, presumably they began to disappear after a while.
Well, they just disappeared. Mm. Well, I mean, most of them, you see, were pretty old anyway. I think the most of them were, what, more 50s upwards. And I mean upwards, you know, to maybe 70 or something like that. And suddenly they disappeared. They weren't there for many, many years after 1950. And then suddenly, I don't know how many jobbers there were, actually, from then on. I really wouldn't like to guess at a guess, actually.
Mm. But your impression was there were certainly a lot more than, say, during the 1960s or 70s.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, I think all the one-man firms disappeared, and some, and then there was even mergers in those days.
Really?
Oh, yes. When we... King & Co. was a firm that went bankrupt, or nearly went bankrupt. He was bailed out. And that was more or less a one-man firm, actually, but he was a bit big, and he got too big, and so, of course, that went wrong. Then there was quite a few mergers. I mean, we merged with, we took over, I suppose one might say, Albert E. Sharp, 1960, I suppose. That was just a merger. I think they never had, I don't believe they had the money to carry on anyway, but nothing untoward about it. And then Blackwell & Co. was another firm that went broke. So we took over them, we took them over because, I mean, most of the firm come to us. So, well, maybe jobbers got together on that one, I believe.
Mm.
Not quite sure now. And so it went on. And then, of course, you know, the whole thing got bigger and bigger, and we moved to offices in Austell House. And then everything started to be computerised, you know, which made things a lot easier for everybody concerned. The books were much bigger. We used to run bigger books, and then we used to... And then everything was done on computers, you know. And those, when it first started, computers were never heard of. Nobody ever run computers. Nobody ever told us how to run the books or what size to what, and we just run them.
Mm.
And then when the company results come out, you know, we didn't used to have to wait for the analyst to tell us what he thought about them. We used to look at them, make up our own mind, and go on making trades. I mean, basically, we never stopped making the price all the way through the day when it came out.
Mm.
So it just went on and on.
You mentioned you were given the nickname Tommy. How did you get that?
Well, I don't really know. All I can recall, when I first went there, I think Pat Derlacher brought it up somehow or the other, because I was a sort of 5 foot nothing gentleman.
Mm.
Well, I would say gentleman. 5 foot nothing, and I think the name Tommy, I suppose, I don't know. I honestly don't know. And it came, and it was stuck all the way through the rest of my life. But no, not only in the office, but then when I went down to the market, it became known as Tommy, and it stuck for 40 years.
Mm.
And still, no, if I walk out now and meet some of the boys at the racetrack and one thing and another, hello, Tommy, and it's incredible. But that's how it's, and a lot of people, I won't say a lot, majority of people in there really didn't know my name was Arthur.
Mm.
Not for years and years and years. And it was always Tommy. And that's how it came in. It was fantastic.
You said that Pat Derlacher was the partner you were standing with when you first were authorised, and you said you couldn't have hoped to have had a better person in terms of learning about jobbing. Was he the person who influenced you most when you were learning?
Absolutely. I mean, he was a jobber of this world, you know, and I was a blue button with him all the time. And I learnt a lot there, because he didn't mind me asking questions, provided he wasn't talking or dealing or anything like that. He didn't mind me asking questions. He didn't mind telling me what he'd done. He didn't mind telling me why he's changing the price of this without doing any business in it and everything like that. And he used to be fabulous from a jobber's point of view. I personally, and I don't think I'm the only one, I think he was one of the best there ever were.
Mm. What made him different from other job is? What would you say his qualities?
Well, I don't really know. Well, I knew at the time the fact that... well, I didn't know at the time, but I learned late. I knew later when I started mixing with other people from that point of view, and that his foresight, it seemed absolutely tremendous, and he was never afraid to take on orders and a quarter or half a million or whatever. And you know, he never changed the price on them. Well, if he wanted to change the price, he thought it was wrong. He did not mind losing money on it in order to straighten the book out. And that's what I think that made him a good jobber. He was never afraid to cut the book if it was wrong. And he was never afraid to build the book up if he thought it was right and he could make a good turn out of it.
And were you dealing in stores, shares, at the time?
No. No, industrials, just industrials. Because then when we got bigger, we took up the store market and we took up textiles. Through mergers, we didn't take them up. You know, they came when we merged with other people. They brought their books with them, which was one lot was textiles and another stores was taken up. And so it went on. And the brewery book, we always ran the brewery book. And except that we went with another firm called Bone Oldham at the time. They used to have a brewery book and we used to